cars, except for official cars and the vehicles of the performers, their assistants, and the festival staff, were banned within 10 miles of the festival stage. Hagbard, George, Harry Coyne, Otto Waterhouse, and Joe pushed their way through shuffling crowds of young people. A VW camper carrying Clark Kent and his Superman rolled past. Next, a huge black 1930s vintage Mercedes slowly made its way past cheering kids. It was surrounded by a square of motorcyclists in white overalls to keep eager fans away. Joe shook his head in admiration at the gleaming supercharger pipes, the glistening hand-rubbed black lacquer, and the wire-spoked wheels. The Landau top of the car was up, but by peering inside, Joe could see several crew-cut blonde heads. A blonde girl suddenly put her face to the window and stared out expressionlessly.
"That's the American Medical Association in that Mercedes," George said.
Hey,
said Harry Coyne.
"We could pitch a bomb into their car and get all them right now."
"You'd kill a lot of other people, too, and leave a lot of unfinished business hanging fire,"
said Hagbard, looking after the Mercedes, which slowly disappeared down the road ahead of them.
"That's a nice machine. It belonged to Field Marshal Gerd von Rundstedt, one of Hitler's ablest generals."
An elephantine black bus carrying the AMA's equipment followed close behind the Mercedes. Silently, it trundled past. "We'll kill the old red rooster. We'll kill the old red rooster." The closed corporation was generally recognized to be the most esoteric and experimental of all rock groups. This was why their following, although fanatical, was relatively small. "It's heavy, all right," most of the youth culture said, "but is it really rock?" The same question, more politely worded, had often been asked by interviewers, and their leader, Peter Paul Mall, had a standard answer.
"It's rock,"
he said somberly.
"And on this rock, I will build a new church."
Then he would giggle, because he was usually stoned during interviews. Reporters made him nervous. In fact, the religious tone was rather prominent when the closed corporation appeared in concert, and the chief complaint was that nobody could understand the chants that accompanied some of the more interplanetary chords they employed. These chants derived from the Enochian keys, which Dr. John Dee had deciphered from the acrostics in the Necromonicon, and in modern times have been most notably employed by the well-known poet Aleister Crowley and the Reverend Anton LaVey of the First Church of Satan in San Francisco. On the night of April 30th, the closed corporation ritually sacrificed a rooster within a pentagram. It gave one last despairing crow before they slit its throat, called upon the barbarous names, dropped a tab of mescaline each, and departed for the concert grounds prepared to unleash vibes that would make even the American Medical Association turn pale with awe. "We'll kill the old red rooster when she comes."
"I just saw Hagbard Jalin,"
said Winifred Sauer.
"Naturally, he'd be here, with all his minions and catamites,"
said Wilhelm Sauer.
"We've got to expect to go right down to the wire on this."
"I wonder what he's planning,"
said Werner Sauer.
"Nothing,"
said Wolfgang Sauer.
"In my opinion, he's planning nothing at all. I know how his mind works. Head full of oriental mystical mush. He's going to rely on his intuition to tell him what to do. He hopes to make it more difficult for us to anticipate his actions, since he himself doesn't know what they will be. But he's wrong. His field of action is drastically limited, and there's nothing he can do to stop us."
First, the towers appeared over the black-green tops of the pines. They looked like penitentiary guard towers, though in fact the men in them were unarmed, and their primary purpose was to house spotlights and loudspeakers. Then the road turned, and they were walking next to a 20-foot-high wire fence. Running parallel to this was an inner fence, 30 feet away and about the same height. Beyond that were bright green hillsides. The promoters of the festival had chopped down and sold all the trees on the hills within the fenced-off area, bulldozed the stumps, and covered the raw earth with fresh sod. Already the green was particularly covered by crowds of people. Tents had popped up like mushrooms, and banners waved in the air. Portable outhouses, painted day-glow orange to make them easy to spot, were set at regular intervals. A vast hum of talking, shouting, singing, and music rose over the hills. Beyond the hills, beyond the central hill where the stage stood, the blue-black waters of Lake Totenkopf heaved and tossed. Even that side of the festival area had its fences and towers. Joe said,
"You'd think they were really worried about someone sneaking in for free."
"These people really know how to build this kind of place,"
said Otto Waterhouse. Hagbard laughed.
"Come on, Otto. Are you racist about Germans?" "I was talking about whites. They've got good big ones in the U.S. too. I've seen a couple."
"I never saw one with a geodesic dome, though,"
said George.
"Look at how big that thing is. Wonder what's in it."
"I read that the Kabouters were going to set up a dome,"
said Joe,
"as a first aid or bad trip station, or something like that."
"Maybe it's a place where you can go hear the music,"
said Harry Coyne.
"Hell, size of this thing, you can barely see people on the stage, much less hear them."
"You haven't heard the loudspeakers they've got,"
said Hagbard.
"When the music starts, they'll be able to hear it all the way to Munich."
They came to a gate. Arching over it was a sign that declared, in red-painted Gothic letters, "Ewige Blumenkraft und ewige Schlagenkraft."
"See?"
said Hagbard.
"Right out in the open. For anyone who understands to read and know that the hour is at hand, they won't be hiding much longer."
"Well,"
said Joe,
"at least it doesn't say Arbeit macht frei."
Hagbard handed in the orange, week-long tickets for his group, and a black-uniformed usher punched them neatly and returned them. They were inside the Ingolstadt Festival. As the sun sank over the far side of Lake Totenkopf, Hagbard and his contingent mounted a hill. A huge sign over the stage announced that the Oklahoma Home Demonstration Club was playing, and the loudspeakers thundered out an old favorite of that group, Custer Stomp. Behind the stage, the four members of the American Medical Association stood apart and gazed out at the sunset. They were wearing iridescent black tunics and trousers. Members of other bands stood together and talked, many of the groups happy to be meeting each other for the first time. They even fraternized with a few intrepid kids who managed to infiltrate past the guards and make it to the backside of the stage hill. But white-suited attendants kept the public and fellow performers away from the American Medical Association. This was generally accepted as the AMA's privilege. They were, after all, universally acclaimed as the greatest rock group in the world. Their records sold the most. Their tours drew audiences that dwarfed even those of the Beatles. Their sound was everywhere. As the Beatles had, for a time, expressed the new freedom of the 60s, so the AMA seemed to epitomize the repressive spirit of the 70s. The secret of their popularity was that they were so appalling. They reminded their fans of all the evils that were being daily visited upon them, and thus hearing and seeing them was like scratching a very bad itch. They suggested that perhaps youth had captured its oppressors or identified with them, and they momentarily turned the pain of the whole scene into pleasure. To learn how to enjoy suffering, since suffering was their lot, kids by the millions flocked to hear the AMA.
"Like a radiant heater,"
said Wolfgang.
"We at the center. Our message projected into a ball of vibrant young human consciousnesses. Massively reflected by them back across the lake. Into the lake to the depths of a mile. There, reaching the sunken army. Raising them, in a sense, from the dead."
"We are so close to realizing the dream of 30,000 years,
said Winifred.
"Will we be able to do it? Will we be the ones who complete the work begun by the great Gruard? And if not, what will become of us?"
"Doubtless we will scream in hell for all eternity,"
said Werner matter-of-factly.
"What would you do to us if we failed?"
"We need fear eternity only if the Eater of Souls is on the scene,"
said Wilhelm.
"And they've still got him imprisoned inside the Pentagon."
"Let no one speak of failure,"
said Wolfgang.
"It is absolutely impossible for us to fail. The plan is foolproof."
Winifred shook her head.
"Fools are precisely what it is not proof against, and you, Wolfgang, know that best of all."
It was dark now. The large tent, made of cloth of gold, was sheltered between the fence and a relatively secluded grassy knoll. There was greatest privacy here, because this corner of the festival area was farthest from the stage, and because the area was full of Discordians. Hagbard went into the tent and stayed there a while. Joe and George sat outside talking. George was thinking that Hagbard was probably in there with Mavis, and he wished he could dash in there and kill the son of a bitch. Joe, agonizingly nervous, suspected that Hagbard was in the tent with a woman, probably Mavis, and he wondered if he should rush in and kill Hagbard while the Discordian leader was occupied. He kept his hand in his pocket, fingers curled around the small pistol.
I circle around.
After about half an hour, Hagbard emerged from the tent, smiling.
Go on in,
he said to Joe.
You're needed in there.
George grabbed Hagbard's arm, trying to sink his fingers in, but the muscle felt like iron, and Hagbard didn't seem to notice.
Who's in there?
He demanded.
Stella,
said Hagbard, looking down at the stage, where the plastic canoe was playing.
And you were fucking her?
Joe asked.
To release the energies, and now I'm supposed to fuck her too. And George after me. And then everybody else. That's left-hand magic, and it's creepy.
Just go in,
Hagbard said.
You'll be surprised. I wasn't fucking Stella. Stella wasn't in there when I was.
Who was?
George asked, thoroughly confused.
My mother,
said Hagbard happily. Joe turned toward the tent. He would make one more effort to trust Chalene, but then... Suddenly the hawk face leaned close to him and Hagbard whispered,
I know what you're planning for afterwards. Do it quickly.
She'll be wearing red pajamas when she comes. On February 2nd, Robert Putney Drake received a book in the mail. The return address, he noted, was Gold and Appel Transfers on Canal Street, one of the corporations owned by that intriguing Chalene fellow who had kept appearing at the best parties for the last year or so. It was titled, Never Whistle While You're Pissing, and the flyleaf had a bold scrawl saying, Best Regards from the Author, followed by a gigantic C like a crescent moon. The publisher was Green and Pleasant Publications, P.O. Box 359, Glencoe, Illinois, 60022. Drake opened it and read a few pages. To his astonishment, several Illuminati secrets were spelled out rather clearly, although in a hostile and sarcastic tone. He flipped the pages, looking for other interesting tidbits. Toward the middle of the book, he found
Definitions and Distinctions. Free market. That condition of society in which all economic transactions result from voluntary choice without coercion. The state. That institution which interferes with the free market through the direct exercise of coercion or the granting of privileges, backed by coercion. Tax. That form of coercion or interference with the free market in which the state collects tribute, the tax, allowing it to hire armed forces to practice coercion in defense of privilege, and also to engage in such wars, adventures, experiments, reforms, etc., as it pleases, not at its own cost, but at the cost of its subjects. Privilege. From the Latin privy, private, and lege, law. An advantage granted by the state and protected by its powers of coercion, a law for private benefit. Usury, that form of privilege or interference with the free market in which one state-supported group monopolizes the coinage and thereby takes tribute, interest, direct or indirect, on all or most economic transactions. Landlordism. That form of privilege or interference with the free market in which one state-supported group owns the land and thereby takes tribute, rent, from those who live, work, or produce on the land. Tariff. That form of privilege or interference with the free market in which commodities produced outside the state are not allowed to compete equally with those produced inside the state. Capitalism. That organization of society, incorporating elements of tax, usury, landlordism, and tariff, which thus denies the free market while pretending to exemplify it. Conservatism. That school of capitalist philosophy which claims allegiance to the free market while actually supporting usury, landlordism, tariff, and sometimes taxation. Liberalism. That school of capitalist philosophy which attempts to correct the injustices of capitalism by adding new laws to the existing laws.
Each time conservatives pass a law creating privilege, liberals pass another law modifying privilege, leading conservatives to pass a more subtle law recreating privilege, etc., until everything not forbidden is compulsory and everything not compulsory is forbidden. Socialism. The attempted abolition of all privilege by restoring power entirely to the coercive agent behind privilege, the state, thereby converting capitalist oligarchy into status monopoly. Whitewashing a wall by painting it black. Anarchism. That organization of society in which the free market operates freely, without taxes, usury, landlordism, tariffs, or other forms of coercion or privilege. Right anarchists predict that in the free market, people would voluntarily choose to compete more often than to cooperate. Left anarchists predict that in the free market, people would voluntarily choose to cooperate more often than to compete. Drake, now totally absorbed, turned the page. What he found seemed to be an anthropological report on an obscure tribe he had never heard of. He quickly recognized it as a satire and a parable. Putting it aside for a moment, he buzzed his secretary and asked to be connected with gold and Appel transfers. In a moment, a voice said,
G&AT, Miss Maris.
Mr. Drake calling Mr. Chalene.
Drake's secretary said,
Mr. Chalene is on an extended voyage.
Miss Maris replied.
But he left a message in case Mr. Drake called.
I'll take it,
Drake said quickly. There was a click as his secretary went off the line.
Mr. Chalene will send an emissary to you at the appropriate time,
Miss Maris said.
He says that you will recognize the emissary because he will bring with him certain artworks of the Gruet era. I'm afraid that is all, sir.
Thank you,
Drake said hollowly, hanging up. He knew the technique. He had used it himself in moving in on the syndicate back in 1936.